many thanks to our great speakers who have spoken before us. Many thanks to Jen for supporting the work of the Rural Women's Movement of KwaZulu-Natal, where I'm coming from. The Rural Women's Movement is working with indigenous, poor, rural, landless women from communities who were forcibly removed from their land way back in 1913. It is made up of more than 500 community-based women's organizations with a total membership of about 15,000 women. Their ages range between 16 and 78 years of age. Faced by legacy of apartheid systems, the province of KwaZulu-Natal is characterized by a deep rural consciousness and social conservatism evidenced in strongly traditionalist social values, including around gender roles and relationships. For the most part of women are located firmly within patriarchal households. That was very evident when we interviewed one of the chairperson of the Community Land Trust in one of the districts, where he said to us, "I'm the manager of my household. I have knowledge about a number of things. Therefore, I don't want my wife getting involved because she might fumble and mess things up. A woman will do things in a female way and mix things up. She may even sell our land to her boyfriends, but the men will be held responsible should there be a problem in the community. When the police come, they ask for the men. So women should follow their husbands." That was very sad on our part, because when the government started the land reform program in 1995, the government made it very clear that all land reform projects, women must be represented and their voice must be heard. But this chairperson, who was supposed to be assisting the project in his community, was against having women in decision-making structures. The social and agrarian history of some districts in the province is marked by conflict and extreme social divisions, in which land conflicts have played an important part. The deeply scarred patterns of contestation over land, territorial boundaries, and labor stretch back to mid-19th century. They involved not only conflict between black landless or land-hungry communities and white land owners, but also clan-based violence within black communities. In one magisterial district where labor tenancy was abolished, more than 20,000 people were forcibly evicted off the white-owned farms between 1969 and 1972. Many of them were dumped in rudimentary resettlement camps close to their former land. The province where I'm coming from is one of the poorest provinces, with more than 70% people living in rural areas, and our rural areas are significantly worse off compared to urban areas. It is estimated that more than 30% of households are headed by women, and women-headed households are worse off compared to household headed by men in terms of poverty. a convenient starting point would be for me to consider in this paper where as African rural community are coming from in terms of gender relations, women, land, and property rights. As the movement, we are advocating for women's independent land and property rights. Pre-colonialism, individuals could not own land. Land was regarded as a sacred gift from umvelingangi and ancestral land. When a child was about to be born, the grandmothers, as a symbol of a, which was symbolizing that if a person comes to this land, Mother Earth is the first person to take care of the newly born baby. The grandmothers would go, while the mother is in labor, they will quickly go outside and dig enough soil to make like a little bed in a hut, put blankets on the soil, and let the woman who is in labor lie on that soil. That soil was kept in the hut for 2 weeks. It was only removed after the child was 2 weeks old. Mother Earth was also regarded as someone who is a home for our ancestral, for our people who had passed on, and was regarded as somebody who feeds the nation through the nation's agricultural activities. Food was produced by individual families, but was not individualized. Communities in that area, when having supper at night, women will come with a bowl of food, and they will all gather in a great grandmother's house, and everybody, children, women, and men, will all sit in a circle, and each mother will come with a bowl, and they will all eat from these bowls of different food. In that way, there were no people who were suffering from starvation, because even if a family did not have enough food to cook, to take to the great-grandmother's house for supper, they will just go without taking anything with them and eat with the rest of the extended family. And it was not only the extended family, it was also the neighbors. I only discovered this year that the uncle that my mother is always talking about was in fact not my grandfather's brother. They were neighbors, and they were so close in such a way that even the children regarded, even my mother and her sisters regarded this neighbor as their uncle. I only discovered this year that uncle was not actually from my grandfather's family. The way communities were staying together and sharing whatever they had. And land was not owned by individuals. People were plowing the land as the community, and the food that was produced from the land was for everybody, even the children. If a woman wants maybe to go for a couple of days, she didn't even have to go to someone and say, please look after my children while I am away. She would just tell the neighbors that she is going away, and the children would go to any house and will find the food. And the great grandmother's house, it was a requisite that there must be food in that house, because there were people who were walking long distances, who were strangers, and if they go past the community, they will knock on the door, and there was always have to be food ready for anybody who could come anytime. Even the children, when they come back from the field, maybe looking after the cattle, they didn't have to go to their mother's house in order to get food. They would go into any house and find food. Mother Earth was regarded as a sacred gift from Umvelinqangi, and no one could own her as an individual. Even property was not owned as an individual property. The household heads, who were usually men, were regarded as managers, and they would not take any decision without consulting their extended family, including the children. Even the children had a voice in how the cattle could be used, and their voice was respected by the elders. Women had access to property, and they were treated with respect. In order for communities to build houses, we were performing what we used to call ilima, where the community would come together in support of a community member who wants to be assistant, maybe to carry out bigger tasks like plowing the land or building a house. The assisting member will be served with drinks and food, and the assisted member will participate in the next ilima. And amalima were happening like in every week, because this week we're building so-and-so's house, and next week we'll be building another person's house. And that practice still exists in some communities in our rural areas. We still, the principles still exist in events like weddings, burials, and credit unions. Colonialism left women without access to land. It took away all that togetherness. People became individuals, and land became individualized, and it was carved into small pieces, and 87% of it was given to the hands of the few white men, and the majority of the nation was only left with 13% of barren land to survive on. And for the in the efforts of the colonizers to push our men into migration, they started saying people cannot have an X number of cattle. It was illegal. People had to reduce their cattle, and the cattle and tilling of the land was the only means of survival for our communities. The migration came with breakdown of community structures, and also breakdown of family values. And as African, we began to look at our households as individual households. it is when we started to see children who are orphans. It is when we started to see children, street children. In 1991, it was estimated that we had 100,000 street children. I don't have the statistics right now. And before the land was taken away from the communities did not need to have money. People could survive without money. My mom is telling me that my grandfather was taking turns to work for money with his brothers. They will negotiate who is going to go and work for money this year, because the others were working at home on the land, and the others were taking care of the cattle. And the money that was earned by that person who had volunteered to go and work for money was not his own money, because the others were at home looking after his cattle, after his family, and plowing the fields. So that money that he brought back home was for the whole extended family. It was not individualized. All of that has gone because of a scarcity of resources and scarcity of land. The breakdown of extended families is seen as the main cause of poverty, which is facing especially women and children in the rural areas. Women and children are representing a population of about 60% who are living under poverty line in the rural areas. As a nation, we are witnessing big evictions of women who are evicted from their marital homes and from their bed homes after the death of their fathers and mother, after the death of their fathers, and also after the death of their husband. The movement's main strategy is to get South African youth, most particularly the youth between the 11 to 19 years old, talking more openly about sex and sexual transmitted diseases and the impact of HIV and AIDS. We strongly believe that this strategy will work because there is substantial evidence from the different countries that HIV prevention programs work. But to be successful, prevention programs must be strategically targeted and sustained over many years in order to bring about lasting transformation. Our dream about this program was motivated by increasing evidence that the HIV and AIDS epidemic, especially in the province of KwaZulu-Natal, where I come from, would affect labor in agriculture, increase malnutrition, add to the problems of rural women, especially female-headed household, arising from gender, division of labor and land rights and resources, and deepen the debt crisis by increased amount of medical expenses for sick members of families and increased number of funerals. It is estimated that as the nation, we lose 600 loved ones every month from AIDS-related diseases like TB and pneumonia. It's also estimated that every day there are 1,500 to 1,800 new infections. It's also worth noting that it is acknowledged in South Africa that land organizations have not, until recently, needed to take account of issues such as HIV and AIDS because of what has been perceived as more pressing issues. However, it is becoming increasingly clear that HIV and AIDS is likely to present one of the greatest challenges to land reform, agricultural production, and capacity building of communities. I touched on the breakdown of family values and what communities see as a result of that is the high rate of teenage pregnancy. More than one third of births in South Africa are to girls under the age of 18. This is one of the highest teenage pregnancy rates in the world. STDs such as syphilis are commonplace among sexually active teenagers. And despite some public education efforts over the past 10 years, condom usage among teenagers remain around 10% and 15%. But there are many interrelated factors contributing to an environment of increasing sexual promiscuity. Abuse and violence among young South Africans, poverty, disintegration of family structures, political liberation, and dysfunctioning schooling are among the main causes shaping the attitude of our young youth, young South Africans. The discussions we have had with the youth show, however, that young people most lack and most want direction from parents and older people. The Minister of Health is predicting that by 2005, about 6 million South Africans will be infected with HIV, of whom 1.5 million are orphan children. Unfortunately, the prevalence rate of HIV in KwaZulu-Natal is considerably higher than the national average. For example, 37.5 of participants in antenatal care clinics are infected. It's evident that more women than men are infected. Reasons of why it's like that, some of them are quite clear. Infections among South African women has increased dramatically, especially among women aged between 20 and 39, and among the poor African women. Women who are poor are doubly vulnerable because they have no economic or social power. In a situation where gender inequality is culturally entrenched, this is frequently associated with violence and abuse. And this is further advancing the spread of HIV. It is worth noting that one of the workshops we have had, more than 50% of the HIV positive colleagues of ours who participated are married and faithful to one partner of their lives. Even those in abusive situations remain in them for financial support, especially for their children. AIDS is also putting more pressure on women as we have to make hard choices in allocating time between household need, childcare, and care of the sick. AIDS poses challenging questions to existing approaches for development, which is part of the reasons why, as a land rights organization, we decided to integrate gender into our work. We see gender as a cross-cutting issue that needs to be integrated into all our rural development projects. In some situations, the epidemic has exposed the failure of previous development interventions to address persisting gender inequalities. In many cases, existing inequalities have been exacerbated by the epidemic. For example, women widowed by AIDS have become increasingly disempowered in terms of access to land. Not one of us is untouched by the rising incidence of sickness and death rapidly engulfing our nation. Not only does this reduce our productivity when we lose valuable team members, but we also find we are ourselves often depressed. We are carrying a heavy burden of grief. Our work has shown that the impact of HIV has also raised the importance of intra-household entitlements to food and other resources, partly due to the use in the number of orphan children being taken in by different families. Gender-sensitive and entitlement-based approach are now more urgent than ever before. I would like, with the permission of our chairperson, Jen, I would like to share a very short story of the four children who lost their mother a couple of weeks ago. This woman was dying of HIV and AIDS after all her family members, including the grandmother and the grandfather of her children. She was the last one to die in the family. And I think because she was the last person to die in the family, she kind of resisted. She didn't want to die. In order for one to come into her room, one has had to have a broom because there were worms crawling around in her room, and her bed was dripping with body fluids. Her body was finished, and her four children, the youngest is a four-year little girl, had to witness that situation. She refused to die until she said to the women who were looking after her, "Oh, I have remembered. I can still die, and my children would not suffer that much. I can remember that someone from somewhere would come and take care of my children." And she asked four women if they could please look after her four children. And they said they'd be happy to assist her. A week later, she passed on. And these four women came to collect the children and took them to their homes. Within a week's time, the children had run away from those homes and came back home. When the community members noticed that the children were back home, it looked like it was like 2 days after they have run away from the areas where they are staying with these foster parents. And one of our colleagues, who is one of our community health workers, called me on the phone to say that there are children who are on their own in their home, and it looks like they haven't eaten for a couple of days, and the community do not have anything to share with the children, because in our country, it's estimated that 43% of the productive, active population is unemployed. And as activists, we are saying 43% is not reflecting what we are seeing in the rural areas, because in the rural areas, we are seeing people who haven't been employed for the last decade. And when the government talks about the 43%, they are talking about the people who are still looking for job, and those statistics do not include those people who have given up looking for jobs. The community health worker who called me on the phone did not even had food for her own children. And because we had a bit of money in our account, I quickly phoned our chairperson and asked her if we could please take some of the money and buy some food for the children. And that was not the part of the reason why that money was raised. We were doing what we were not supposed to do, because that money was raised to buy uniform and food, school uniform, and pay for the school fees for the children. So the situation is quite scary, and it doesn't look like it's gonna come right very soon, especially in the rural areas. Thank you very much. From communities who were forcibly removed from their land way back in 1913. It is made up of more than 500 community-based women's organizations with a total membership of about 15,000 women. Their ages range between 16 and 78 years of age. Faced by legacy of apartheid systems, the province of KwaZulu-Natal is characterized by a deep rural consciousness and social conservatism evidenced in strongly traditionalist social values, including around gender roles and relationships. For the most part of women are located firmly within patriarchal households. That was very evident when we interviewed one of the chairperson of the Community Land Trust in one of the districts, where he said to us, "I'm the manager of my household. I have knowledge about a number of things. Therefore, I don't want my wife getting involved because she might fumble and mess things up. A woman will do things in a female way and mix things up. She may even sell our land to her boyfriends, but the men will be held responsible should there be a problem in the community. When the police come, they ask for the men. So women should follow their husbands." That was very sad on our part, because when the government started the land reform program in 1995, the government made it very clear that all land reform projects, women must be represented and their voice must be heard. But this chairperson, who was supposed to be assisting the project in his community, was against having women in decision-making structures. The social and agrarian history of some districts in the province is marked by conflict and extreme social divisions, in which land conflicts have played an important part. The deeply scarred patterns of contestation over land, territorial boundaries, and labor stretch back to mid-19th century. They involved not only conflict between black landless or land-hungry communities and white landowners, but also clan-based violence within black communities. In one magisterial district where labor tenancy was abolished, more than 20,000 people were forcibly evicted off the white-owned farm farms between 1969 and 1972. Many of them were dumped in rudimentary resettlement camps close to their former land. The province where I'm coming from is one of the poorest provinces, with more than 70% people living in rural areas, and our rural areas are significantly worse off compared to urban areas. It is estimated that more than 30% of households are headed by women, and women-headed households are worse off compared to households headed by men in terms of poverty. A convenient starting point would be for me to consider in this paper where as African rural community are coming from in terms of gender relations, women, land, and property rights. As the movement, we are advocating for women's independent land and property rights. Pre-colonialism, individuals could not own land. Land was regarded as a sacred gift from umvelingangi and ancestral land. When a child was about to be born, the grandmothers, as a symbol of a, which was symbolizing that if a person comes to this land, Mother Earth is the first person to take care of the newly born baby. The grandmothers would go while the mother is in labor, they will quickly go outside and dig enough soil to make like a little bed in a hut, put blankets on the soil, and let the woman who is in labor lie on that soil. That soil was kept in the hut for 2 weeks. It was only removed after the child was 2 weeks old. Mother Earth was also regarded as someone who is a home for our ancestral, for our people who had passed on, and was regarded as somebody who feeds the nation through the nation's agricultural activities. Food was produced by individual families, but was not individualized. Communities in that area, when having supper at night, women will come with a bowl of food and they will all gather in a great grandmother's house, and everybody, children, women, and men, will all sit in a circle, and each mother will come with a bowl, and they will all eat from these bowls of different food. In that way, there were no people who were suffering from starvation, because even if a family did not have enough food to cook, to take to the great-grandmother's house for supper, they will just go without taking anything with them and eat with the rest of the extended family. And it was not only the extended family, it was also the neighbors. I only discovered this year that the uncle that my mother is always talking about was in fact not my grandfather's brother. They were neighbors, and they were so close in such a way that even the children regarded, even my mother and her sisters regarded this neighbor as their uncle. I only discovered this year that that uncle was not actually from my grandfather's family. The way communities were staying together and sharing whatever they had. And land was not owned by individuals. People were plowing the land as the community, and the food that was produced from the land was for everybody, even the children. If a woman wants maybe to go for a couple of days, she didn't even have to go to someone and say, please look after my children while I am away. She would just tell the neighbors that she is going away, and the children would go to any house and will find the food. And the great grandmother's house, it was a requisite that there must be food in that house, because there were people who were walking long distances, who were strangers, and if they go past the community, they will knock on the door, and there was always have to be food ready for anybody who could come anytime. Even the children, when they come back from the field, maybe looking after the cattle, they didn't have to go to their mother's house in order to get food. They would go into any house and find food. Mother Earth was regarded as a sacred gift from Umvelinqangi, and no one could own her as an individual. Even property was not owned as an individual property. The household heads, who were usually men, were regarded as managers, and they would not take any decision without consulting their extended family, including the children. Even the children had a voice in how the cattle could be used, and their voice was respected by the elders. Women had access to property, and they were treated with respect. In order for communities to build houses, we were performing what we used to call ilima, where the community would come together in support of a community member who wants to be assistant, maybe to carry out bigger tasks like plowing the land or building a house. The assisting member will be served with drinks and food, and the assisted member will participate in the next ilima. And amalima were happening like in every week, because this week we're building so-and-so's house, and next week we'll be building another person's house. And that practice still exists in some communities in our rural areas. We still, the principles still exist in events like weddings, burials, and credit unions. Colonialism left women without access to land. It took away all that togetherness. People became individuals, and land became individualized, and it was carved into small pieces, and 87% of it was given to the hands of the few white men, and the majority of the nation was only left with 13% of barren land to survive on. And for the in the efforts of the colonizers to push our men into migration, they started saying people cannot have an X number of cattle. It was illegal. People had to reduce their cattle. And the cattle and tilling of the land was the only means of survival for our communities. The migration came with breakdown of community structures and also breakdown of family values. And as African, we began to look at our households as individual households. It is when we started to see children who are orphans. It is when we started to see children, street children. In 1991, it was estimated that we had 100,000 street children. I don't have the statistics right now. And before the land was taken away from the communities did not need to have money. People could survive without money. My mom is telling me that my grandfather was taking turns to work for money with his brothers. They will negotiate who is going to go and work for money this year, because the others were working at home on the land, and the others were taking care of the cattle. And the money that was earned by that person who had volunteered to go and work for money was not his own money, because the others were at home looking after his cattle, after his family, and plowing the fields. So that money that he brought back home was for the whole extended family. It was not individualized. All of that has gone because of a scarcity of resources and scarcity of land. The breakdown of extended families is seen as the main cause of poverty, which is facing especially women and children in the rural areas. Women and children are representing a population of about 60% who are living under poverty line in the rural areas. As a nation, we are witnessing big evictions of women who are evicted from their marital homes and from their bed homes after the death of their fathers and mother, after the death of their fathers, and also after the death of their husband. The movement's main strategy is to get South African youth, most particularly the youth between the 11 to 19 years old, talking more openly about sex and sexual transmitted diseases and the impact of HIV and AIDS. We strongly believe that this strategy will work because there is substantial evidence from the different countries that HIV prevention programs work. But to be successful, prevention programs must be strategically targeted and sustained over many years in order to bring about lasting transformation. Our dream about this program was motivated by increasing evidence that the HIV and AIDS epidemic, especially in the province of KwaZulu-Natal, where I come from, would affect labor in agriculture, increase malnutrition, add to the problems of rural women, especially female-headed households, arising from gender, division of labor and land rights and resources, and deepen the debt crisis by increased amount of medical expenses for sick members of families and increased number of funerals. It is estimated that as the nation, we lose 600 loved ones every month from AIDS-related diseases like TB and pneumonia. It's also estimated that every day there are 1,500 to 1,800 new infections. It's also worth noting that it is acknowledged in South Africa that land organizations have not, until recently, needed to take account of issues such as HIV and AIDS because of what has been perceived as more pressing issues. However, it is becoming increasingly clear that HIV and AIDS is likely to present one of the greatest challenges to land reform, agricultural production, and capacity building of communities. I touched on the breakdown of family values and what communities see as a result of that is the high rate of teenage pregnancy. More than one-third of births in South Africa are to girls under the age of 18. This is one of the highest teenage pregnancy rates in the world. STDs such as syphilis are commonplace among sexually active teenagers. And despite some public education efforts over the past 10 years, condom usage among teenagers remain around 10% and 15%. But there are many interrelated factors contributing to an environment of increasing sexual promiscuity. Abuse and violence among young South Africans, poverty, disintegration of family structures, political liberation and dysfunctioning schooling are among the main causes shaping the attitude of our young youth, young South Africans. The discussions we have had with the youth show, however, that young people most lack and most want direction from parents and older people. The Minister of Health is predicting that by 2005, about 6 million South Africans will be infected with HIV, of whom 1.5 million are orphan children. Unfortunately, the prevalence rate of HIV in KwaZulu-Natal is considerably higher than the national average. For example, 37.5 of participants in antenatal care clinics are infected. It's evident that more women than men are infected. Reasons of why it's like that, some of them are quite clear. Infections among South African women has increased dramatically, especially among women aged between 20 and 39, and among the poor African women. Women who are poor are doubly vulnerable because they have no economic or social power. In a situation where gender inequality is culturally entrenched, this is frequently associated with violence and abuse, and this is further advancing the spread of HIV. It is worth noting that one of the workshops we have had more than 50% of the HIV positive colleagues of ours who participated are married and faithful to one partner of their lives. Even those in abusive situations remain in them for financial support, especially for their children. AIDS is also putting more pressure on women as we have to make hard choices in allocating time between household need, childcare, and care of the sick. AIDS poses challenging questions to existing approaches for development, which is part of the reasons why, as a land rights organization, we decided to integrate gender into our work. We see gender as a cross-cutting issue that needs to be integrated into all our rural development projects. In some situations, the epidemic has exposed the failure of previous development interventions to address persisting gender inequalities. In many cases, existing inequalities have been exacerbated by the epidemic. For example, women widowed by AIDS have become increasingly disempowered in terms of access to land. Not one of us is untouched by the rising incidence of sickness and death rapidly engulfing our nation. Not only does this reduce our productivity when we lose valuable team members, but we also find we are ourselves often depressed. We are carrying a heavy burden of grief. Our work has shown that the impact of HIV has also raised the importance of intra-household entitlements to food and other resources, partly due to the use in the number of orphan children being taken in by different families. Gender-sensitive and entitlement-based approach are now more urgent than ever before. I would like, with the permission of our chairperson, Jen, I would like to share a very short story of the four children who lost their mother a couple of weeks ago. This woman was dying of HIV and AIDS after all her family members, including the grandmother and the grandfather of her children. She was the last one to die in the family. And I think because she was the last person to die in the family, she kind of resisted. She didn't want to die. In order for one to come into her room, one has had to have a broom because there were worms crawling around in her room, and her bed was dripping with body fluids. Her body was finished, and her four children, the youngest is a four-year little girl, had to witness that situation. She refused to die until she said to the women who were looking after her, "Oh, I have remembered. I can still die, and my children would not suffer that much. I can remember that someone from somewhere would come and take care of my children." And she asked four women if they could please look after her four children. And they said they'd be happy to assist her. A week later, she passed on. And these four women came to collect the children and took them to their homes. Within a week's time, the children had run away from those homes and came back home. When the community members noticed that the children were back home, it looked like it was like 2 days after they have run away from the areas where they are staying with these foster parents. And one of our colleagues who is one of our community health workers called me on the phone to say that there are children who are on their own in their home, and it looks like they haven't eaten for a couple of days, and the community do not have anything to share with the children, because in our country, it's estimated that 43% of the productive, active population is unemployed. And as activists, we are saying 43% is not showing, is not reflecting what we are seeing in the rural areas. Because in the rural areas, we are seeing people who haven't been employed for the last decade. And when the government talks about the 43%, they are talking about the people who are still looking for job. And those statistics do not include those people who have given up looking for jobs. The community health worker who called me on the phone did not even have food for her own children. And because we had a bit of money in our account, I quickly phoned our chairperson and asked her if we could please take some of the money and buy some food for the children. And that was not the part of the reason why that money was raised. We were doing what we were not supposed to do, because that money was raised to buy uniform and food, no, not food, school uniform, and pay for the school fees for the children. So the situation is quite scary, and it doesn't look like it's gonna come right very soon, especially in the rural areas. Thank you very much.